You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, February 17th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland-In for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Coming to you live with HD-ish. Looks good, guys? All right.
People are saying it looks crystal clear.
Oh, very nice. On the program today, James Kilgore, author of Understanding Ecarceration, Electronic Monitoring, The Surveillance State and the Future of Mass Incarceration. Meanwhile, the U.S. and U.K. claim that Russia is lying about withdrawing 7,000 troops from Ukraine's border. He said, she said, but I don't think neither he nor she want a war, even though they're posturing as such, fingers crossed. There is a massive backlog of Afghan humanitarian parole applications. The U.S. has processed less than 5% of them since July 2021 and have approved less than 10% of that 5%. So a very small amount. But it's not like we owe it to them or anything. COVID cases are currently on the decline in every state in the country, which is very welcome news. But West Virginia, Alabama, and Kentucky, all states with low vaccine or vaccination rates, they're still seeing the country's highest hospitalization total.
Hundreds of thousands of extra deaths from Omicron because people didn't get vaccinated. And it's not all because of misinformation. A lot of it's because of our horrible health system, but some of it's because of misinformation.
Yep. The NFL has tapped a familiar face to represent them in Brian Flores' racial discrimination lawsuit. Former Attorney General Loretta Lynch. That's some honorable work, folks. An analysis of 40 cities has found, 40 U.S. cities, that one in seven homes sold by were sold last year were bought by investors. So private equity, corporate investment, with majority black neighborhoods heavily targeted. And lastly, Amazon is being pressured to divest from Omni Air International, which it co-owns, as the airline whose logistics intermediary was also responsible for transferring prisoners to CIA black sites has been found to have tortured and abused migrants that were being deported on its flights. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen and everyone in between. I hope that you're having a lovely day so far. I mean, it's looking pretty good, right? We had a tech day yesterday, upgraded some things. Feel like I'm coming to you in a more crystal clear visual situation.
And we're still working out the kinks, folks. So if there's a little bit of quality issues, we'll be addressing those in the coming days.
Yeah, for sure. All right, well, let's get into one of these stories. This is because we're celebrating the... I'm sorry, guys. I've been messing on the chat. Do we have an echo on something? There's Okay. Sorry about that. now I can concentrate. so there's a really important primary happening, and it's going to happen soon in Pennsylvania. I think this is a huge opportunity for the left with John Fetterman surging, maintaining a significant lead in polling. And there was a piece in Politico the other day that I wanted to highlight because you rarely see pieces like this, and this is a win for the left thus far, if this is maintained. There was another Politico piece today talking about how Democrats fear that they've lost the rural vote forever. Someone like John Fetterman would be a step forward and actually I think would have a lot of national appeal if he ever chose to run for president or something like that. Honestly, I know that there are some things in his past that he might have to overcome, but the point is that the fact that he's courting unions, the fact that he has made it a priority to reach out to rural voters, that's a huge plus, as opposed to someone like Connor Lamb. So Holly Otterbein, I believe, wrote this piece in Politico. She's done some deep dives into, there we go, look at that, leftist candidates before. Her piece is called "The Left Neutralizes the Dem Establishment in Pennsylvania Senate Primary," which is, that's, is that up on the screen, guys? Sorry. No, it's all right. We're still working it out. Here she writes, "Connor Lamb is the kind of swing state Senate candidate who used to make Democratic power brokers swoon. A former Marine and prosecutor, Lamb catapulted onto the national scene in 2018 when he flipped a House seat that former President Donald Trump carried by nearly 20 points. President Joe Biden said the young centrist lawmaker reminds him of his late son, Beau. Yet for all his pedigree as a battleground state candidate, Lamb remains mired in the Democratic primary for Pennsylvania's open Senate seat, trailing progressive frontrunner Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman in both fundraising and the polls. Even more surprising, the party establishment hasn't swooped in to help Lamb, despite the fact that Democratic leaders have aggressively recruited candidates with a profile like his to run for Senate in the past. Lamb's predicament offers a window into how much the Democratic Party has changed in recent years. Progressives have gained a major foothold, small dollar fundraising has upended election dynamics, and moderate white men like Lamb are no longer shoo-ins." But this, in terms of a Senate primary, I feel this is fairly unprecedented for a candidate like Fetterman to be holding on to this lead when you do have someone like Connor Lamb, who the piece will go into later, how it's not like he's completely without funds. The infamous James Carville is working with some sort of super PAC to help fund his effort here, naturally. But he, despite having all the pedigree that basically Democratic establishment types have appreciated in the past, he's been unable to make leads and make gains in polling commensurate with the hype that he gets. He was quoted in this piece saying, "If online fundraising was what determined these elections, you'd have either Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump as the president," which is interesting because Donald Trump was the president. That's a little bit further down. Donald Trump used to be the president. He's no longer the president, but that was a huge part of why he actually won, was the fact that he did have grassroots support.
I mean, both parties have, particularly rural voters, have completely forgotten them. And from the Democrat Party, like, the policy stuff, I think, is kind of clear. A lot of folks need things like healthcare.
Right.
Right. And rural hospitals need an injection. I think Bernie was only particularly good on this, although I don't think it got the emphasis it needed.
But it's also just not important to, and not applicable to make a comparison between a presidential run and a Senate run. When it comes to these races, congressional races, Senate races, no, small dollars actually are a pretty good indicator. And it's not just small dollars coming in from outside. He's kind of doing an outside-inside strategy here, Fetterman, and he's making sure that he courts a lot of the local unions and the groups in Pennsylvania that, you know, that he supports and that support him. Fetterman, the only candidate in the Democratic field who has run and won statewide, is leading in public and private polls. Last year, Fetterman also raised nearly $12 million from a massive network of small dollar donors, compared to $4 million for Lamb. So again, he's started running early. He's had success in that area. And Connor Lamb is trying to keep up with some of the super PAC money that's flowing in. But as I mentioned, it's not just the small dollar donors. It's also the content and the way that Fetterman is running his campaign that makes me encouraged. A recent development could help Lamb to close the money gap with Fetterman, as I mentioned earlier. A pro-Lamb super PAC, which is looking to raise more than $8 million, has emerged. A document promoting the group listed the firm founded by Biden's pollster, John Anzalone, as a part of the team. And of course, James Carville is involved as well, sending out emails on his behalf. But the point is, this is an encouraging race, and I think that it behooves the left to get behind Fetterman here. He has a real chance of winning not just the primary, but the general election. He has the pedigree of being the lieutenant governor. He has the strategy that I think is accurate, and he has a lot of the politics that we subscribe to here on the show. And the fact that he is running towards unions makes me very excited.
Yeah, I mean, I think like these things are fairly clear when people like James Carville get involved with candidates like Lamb.
Right. But let's also turn to another state, the one that we're currently in, not just Pennsylvania, because there have been constant claims from New Yorkers and whining about crime, basically. And it's usually from really wealthy people. If you guys saw that unhinged Andy Cohen rant on New Year's Eve about how the worst mayor is finally leaving the city, that's pretty much what you get when you talk to wealthy New Yorkers about de Blasio versus Eric Adams. There's no specifics whatsoever. There's just a sense that crime is really out of control. And then like what you follow up, what's the next thing he did that you don't like? That's basically it. But Eric Adams believes that pushing a tough on crime stance is going to be his bread and butter as the mayor of New York. So much so that he's kind of fudging the numbers. Well, not fudging the numbers, but at the very least, fudging the graph.
No, this is fudging the numbers.
Okay, look at this. Look, if you guys can see this, look at this graph.
The major and violent crime has increased.
And right.
Yes. So now.
So they show that in between 2017 and 2021, major and violent crime has increased, and that orange bar, it looks huge. It looks massive.
It is literally double the size of any of the other.
Right. I mean, wow.
So it looks like we've had what, like just eyeballing this from a distance away, it'd see a 250% increase in violent crime. Is that what this shows?
If you look really closely at the fine print, in fact, it does not. This was pointed out by Brad Lander on Twitter. 7.5% of an increase between 2017 and 2021. That is because of the pandemic, basically.
Yeah, like that's the thing is, like, people say the left doesn't care about, you know, this sort of stuff. And, like, I'll say, like, I know. Oh, so let me cut back to Emma away from our screen there. Like, if you know people that work retail, like, there is a change that's happened during the pandemic because people are a little bit more desperate. So you see a lot more stuff of people trying to get through checkout lines and, oh, I guess, like, maybe we'll try to sneak some stuff in the cart or maybe just try to walk through stuff. And it's often stuff like diapers, and it's horrible. And it is a crime that we've left people to such desperate, like, measures for this stuff. And, like, sure, there might be certain technological things, like people can move this merchandise that they steal better. That's leading to some of like the higher profile things that you're seeing. But guess what? There's a supply and demand side of this thing. And maybe this is on the technology on the supply side has made it easier, but there's also a demand side where people need to buy detergent for cheaper than they have it at the main stores. And what does that say about what we're doing to folks? As we have Jen Psaki saying, like, we don't want to incentivize people to sit at home. We want them to get back to work and basically serve the economy. Like, this is the price you have to pay.
Yes. Because people, as you say, people are increasingly desperate. And so, to be fair, Matt, here, Eric Adams, despite the misleading chart that seems to show that violent and major crime has increased by 1,000,000% when it's 7.5% over 4 years, maybe it's different when it comes to petty crime. Just kidding. Judd Legum of Popular Information, which is a great newsletter, crunched the numbers a few days ago on this. According to the data, there is a modest rise in reported shoplifting incidents compared to the year before the pandemic began. There were 3,700,918 complaints of retail theft citywide in 2019 and 43,864 such complaints in 2021, an increase of about 15%. But complaints are not a perfect measure of crime trends because not all thefts are reported. Fine. But it's a 15% increase in shoplifting over that period of time, which that period of time tracks entirely with an increase in precarity, a desperation due to the pandemic, people losing their jobs, people unable to work or maybe having to leave their jobs because they have to take care of their kids who are at home, or their workplace is unsafe. I mean, that is exactly what happens when we're in a dire economic situation. So there is no reason to panic. And yet, it seems like for Eric Adams, it's actually quite beneficial to create a panic and ride that wave, which is why we see that misrepresentation of data.
I mean, it was a big wave to ride in the 90s. And I think you will see the Democrat, especially like the ones who are rooting for Eric Adams in this, return to a playbook like that before they go to some like more radical measures that might actually like address the root causes of this sort of stuff.
And we should also say that Eric Adams did just propose his $98 billion budget, zero cuts to the NYPD. So everybody who said that we had national Democrats saying Nancy Pelosi, people like that, Chauvin's conviction, it was a historic moment. Well, the fact that it was important.
Yeah, but you
that
got
he got
some
convicted,
time.
Right? It was a historic moment for you because now you don't have to worry about any systemic change. And then we're also seeing this here in New York, of course. All right, we have to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will be joined by James Kilgore. We are back, and we are joined by James Kilgore, longtime leftist activist and author of Understanding Ecarceration, Electronic Monitoring, the Surveillance State, and the Future of Mass Incarceration. James, thank you so much for being here today. I'm very excited to talk to you because your book talks a little bit about your firsthand experience being under state surveillance for much of your adulthood. But I also Wikipedia'd you and saw some of your longtime activism and the price that you paid for it. So I guess we can start there. Talk a little bit about your experience of being under state surveillance, both in prison and under electronic surveillance outside of prison.
Okay, well, I mean, as I talk about in the book, I was actually, I was a fugitive for 27 years on federal possession of explosive charges from the mid-1970s. And I spent most of that time in Southern Africa. I spent a lot of that time doing work with social justice movements, with the liberation movements in South Africa and Zimbabwe fighting against apartheid and colonialism. In 2002, I was extradited back to the U.S., and I served 6.5 years in prison.
I'm so sorry, James. One sec. We're having a bit of a technical difficulty.
Audio's fine.
They can't hear him.
Well, people are saying they
can't. So, I'm sorry. Keep going. I apologize. This is our first day on a new system, so we're working through some of the kinks.
So I'm a guinea pig, huh?
Yes, you are. Exactly.
Okay, well, I hope I can pass here. So I was saying, I spent 6.5 years in prison in federal and state institutions in California. when I came out in 2009, I was placed on an electronic monitor. The day after I got home, they put this thing on my ankle, and they told me I would only be allowed out of the house from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. Monday through Friday. And that really kind of changed my idea of what freedom was going to look like after all those years of thinking about it. And I began to ask some questions about this device. Who made the rules for it? Who was making money off of it? And probably most importantly for today, where was this device going in terms of its capacity to surveil? At that time, it was tracking location, but it didn't have a lot of the bells and whistles that are on devices now. And it wasn't really connected to a broader surveillance state that it is now, which is kind of what I talk about in the book, which I refer to as e-carceration.
And it's not just a surveillance state, and we can get into that. It's very global, which is part of what's terrifying about a lot of this technology. But I guess I also hope you could expand on how your activist work was very much a part of the liberation politics of the 70s and during that period. I mean, how did your activism and your experience with that maybe give you a different perspective on the e-carceration, electronic monitoring that you later dealt with in your life?
Okay, so my activism in the 70s in the U.S. was, I mean, I was involved in anti-war movement, but I became involved in revolutionary violence, as we called it. I have a lot of reflections on that particular choice, but I think I learned a very different politics when I went to Southern Africa and I became part of mass movements, which involved ordinary workers, ordinary community members, who, despite not having extensive formal education, who despite having English as their fourth or fifth language, were still able to conduct incredible political debates and political campaigns and begin to develop a model of participatory democracy, which involved ordinary people making decisions and building organizations and being able to pull 3 million people out on any given day on a general strike. So that kind of activity really changed my idea about what politics should look like. And that's why when I came back to the U.S., I looked around inside these prisons and I just saw this endless sea of bodies coming through the gate, disproportionately black, disproportionately brown, overwhelmingly poor. And I had to try to figure out what was going on here because I hadn't really followed this phenomenon of mass incarceration. So when I came out, I had taken the decision that I wasn't going to be able to go back to South Africa because I was on parole. So I was going to do work in this community in the U.S. around the issues of mass incarceration and try to apply some of the lessons that I'd learned about movement building and organizing in South Africa in the U.S., which is a very different politics than what I embodied in the 1970s.
So I guess we can start there because you do talk a lot about the racial biases in some of these programs. There is a sense sometimes that from people that the electronic monitoring, home surveillance, being outside of the prison, that's got to be applied basically equally to people when that's not, of course, the case.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, one of the remarkable things about electronic monitoring is the fact that we have almost no data on it. We do have numbers for people in prison. We can get racial breakdowns of who's in prison. But I mean, I've sent out a whole lot of Freedom of Information Act requests to states, to counties, and so forth, trying to get them to provide simple data about electronic monitoring. How many people do you have on it? What's a racial breakdown of it? How much are they paying on it if they are paying? And most importantly, how many people are being sent back to jail or to prison for minor violations, coming home late from work because the bus is delayed, having to take a child to the hospital without permission and so forth. So we don't really have data to even know what the racial bias within electronic monitoring is. The few places we do have, I mean, they're as shocking as the racial data on mass incarceration. In Chicago, 70% of the people on electronic monitoring pretrial are Black, in a county that's 25% Black. In Los Angeles, 70% of the people on electronic monitoring are Black, in a jurisdiction that's 8% Black. So there's disproportionate usage of electronic monitoring, which mirrors what happens in the mass incarceration system as a whole in prisons and jails and immigration prisons.
And we can expand on that a little bit, but it might be helpful to, if I could ask you to define the term surveillance capitalism, which is a through line in your book. And how did the rise of surveillance capitalism coincide with the rise of global neoliberalism?
Well, I mean, surveillance capitalism as an entity really means that that data becomes the new sort of the new raw material for making money. So all these technologies, many of which I detail in as e-carceration, whether it's license plate readers, street cameras, facial recognition, electronic monitoring being kind of the classic because it's clearly a process of incarceration that's more like a prison or a jail than, say, facial recognition, which people don't necessarily associate with depriving people of their liberty. But all of this is used as a way for companies to gather data on us to try to predict our behavior and then to use those predictions either to control us if we are what I call the criminalized sector of the working class, that is poor people who are already marginalized, who are maybe been in the criminal legal system, been in the mental health system, been in substance abuse programs and so forth. All of these people are already being watched and being controlled and being blocked from access to opportunity. But then we have the broad surveillance of cell phone calls, emails, and so forth, all of which gather more and more data, which go to the cloud, which is owned by Amazon, Google, etc. And we don't know what happens to it, but I think we can guess when we get all these messages popping in onto our screens about buy this, buy that, and they're talking about something we just sent an email about 2 minutes ago.
Yeah, well, which makes your comment about how you have sent FOIA requests and tried to get some transparency on this issue especially ironic, because the breadth and the wealth of data in this area has got to be infinite.
Absolutely. But what happens is that the companies that sign the contracts for electronic monitoring aren't held to any accountability at all. So I've also sent around Freedom of Information Act requests to many jurisdictions asking them to give me reports, evaluations, assessments of the impact of their so-called programs. And I think I've managed to get about two reports that were generated by a jurisdiction or by a company. It's not part of their contract. The only thing that's stipulated in the contract, how much you're going to pay for the devices and what are the kind of technical specs of these devices. But there's nothing about accountability. What are the rules going to be for the people who are on it? And how are we going to see if it's having an impact? Because I mean, I call this in the book, I refer to this as the mythology of electronic monitoring. We assume it's doing something because people say this is what it's supposed to do. But there's no data, there's no proof, as you point out, in this era where, you know, data rules, but all of a sudden we have this surveillance technology that's gathering all this data and we can't even access it to know what it's saying about us or how it's being used against us, unless we go to apply to, you know, rent an apartment or apply for credit, and all of a sudden, you know, we get these numbers and these rejections back without explanation. So it's really a cloud of mystery.
A cloud of mystery. There we go. Very unintentional pun potentially. But I mean, I can't help but think of someone like Steven Donziger in this case, who's been the victim of this as well. Leftist activists like yourself who've undergone this. And of course, the disproportionate Black and brown people that have been victimized by this kind of stuff. And electronic surveillance and incarceration. And the thing about it too, that the purpose of it is control, really. This is the politics of control. So there's no stated purpose for the people, but for the state, for the powerful, there is a lot of value in being able to monitor people, specifically people, that you want to be good members of a capitalist society and good soldiers, there is of course value in that for them.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, one of the things, when Edward Snowden came out with his revelations and some of the other ones that basically let us know that the NSA is looking at our phone calls and looking at our email, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, a lot of people responded to that. And I think, upper middle class white people in particular saying, why are you gathering data on me? I haven't done anything. Go after those people over there. But those people over there are the same people that are impacted by mass incarceration, by mass criminalization, who get arrested for sleeping in public or for urinating on a tree or something and end up in this cycle of incarceration. But those are the same people that are criminalized by this surveillance technology, by these technologies of incarceration. And the state wants to keep an eye on those people, to control those people, as you point out, wants to punish them. And this technology becomes a technology of punishment and control.
So there is, I would, and you write about this too, but there is likely let me put it this way. I've been very skeptical of groups like Koch Industries or the Koch brothers, and their odd push to cut back on mass incarceration. Part of that is because they want to cut costs so that taxes can be slashed even further, of course. But to me, there is this, there seems to be a push for not the abolition of the prison industrial complex, but surveillance capitalism and electronic surveillance as a replacement. Is that something that you've observed and that you have fears about?
Well, yes. I mean, that's really what triggered me to do all the research, to go around and interview people that have been on electronic monitoring to try to counter the notion that electronic monitors represent an alternative to incarceration. In the same way that other kinds of more punitive alternatives like drug courts and mental health courts and so forth that are really infused with this notion of punishment, what we call the punishment paradigm. So electronic monitoring, we refer to it. I mean, I work for an organization called Media Justice, and we've had a campaign called Challenging Incarceration for several years. And part of what we try to push out on that is, number one, to change the narrative that electronic monitoring is not an alternative to incarceration, but it's an alternative form of incarceration. And secondly, that, as we've already mentioned in this discussion, that it is part of the surveillance state, or as you put it, the global surveillance state, or the global use of this technology. And that's one of the things I try to emphasize in the book, to connect the dots between what happens on people's ankle. So in the book, I'm moving from people's ankle outward for the to look at the way the technology is used in immigration, the way it's used, let's say, for example, in Gaza against Palestinians, and right, so forth. So I want us to understand that, it's not just an ankle shackle, and I don't call it bracelet because it's not jewelry. I mean, that's another thing that we do, is we normalize this by coming up with neutral, even positive terms for them, but that's not what they are.
Absolutely. And I definitely want to talk about Palestine and zoom out with you. But another piece that I think is a bit dystopian and scares people about this expanding surveillance state is the usage of facial recognition. And there are, of course, racial biases in that. Can you talk a little bit about your research in that area and what you found?
Well, I think facial recognition is, there's been so many studies of it to show basically that It can't recognize black people. It can't identify. It claims to be able to, that it's neutral, that it's not biased, like all of these technologies do. That's part of their selling point is it's technology. It doesn't have bias. Humans have bias. Technology doesn't. So somehow we're supposed to accept that myth. But we know that Oprah Winfrey gets identified as a man in facial recognition technology. I mean, there's all these instances where people, they just can't be identified. And it's black women who kind of ironically, given the punitive nature of the system, it's black women who are most likely to be misidentified by this technology. But yet it just keeps spreading and without people having accountability. Now, there have been some initiatives, like in San Francisco, they've banned the use of it by local government, and there's other initiatives in Massachusetts and so forth, because with some of these technologies, there is no positive use for them. We talk about reforming and changing them. There is no positive use for facial recognition technology that I can see.
Yeah, except, I mean, then you'll have people in government or potentially companies that have quite lucrative contracts in order to provide this technology basically say, well, play out life as if it's a 24 episode. You got a terrorist with a bomb and you've got 24. I mean, that's when we need these technologies, but that's not what they're used for. It's just obviously not what they're used for, especially because that situation might happen once in a decade or a blue moon, if at all.
Right. Also, and I mean, it's not as if people who might be targeted like that aren't going to figure out that maybe they should put a plastic nose on or something and distort their face. I mean, it's just like a license plate readers is another technology like that. People, I live in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. We just had a big battle with city councils over license plate readers and trying to show that it's easy enough to misidentify a license plate number. If people are going to actually do violent crime, they're quite likely to go out and steal somebody else's license plate and put that on their car. So there's instances where people get pulled over and, get rousted as if they're bank robbers or something when all they are is the victim of a license plate switch. So these technologies are just not what they're cracked up to be, but there's no sense of making these companies accountable.
Right. Well, it's for the powerful, there's no downside for them. These companies are making a lot of money off of contracts with the government, and the government is expanding its power, which is bipartisan. That's one of the bipartisan parts of our government. And before we move on to the more global implications of this, something occurred to me because you talked a little bit about how there's the sanitizing language of an ankle bracelet as opposed to an ankle cuff. But the whole technology as incarceration is in and of itself sanitizing. Because there's, like you said before, there's a sense that, if it's a technology, then it can't have racial biases. It's almost religious in the way that people approach it. That there is a sense that it's omnipotent and fair. I feel like it does sanitize the entire experience of incarceration and of surveillance in and of itself.
Oh, yes, for sure. And I think so. The way we've tried to push back against that, because there's so little data, the data we have is the lived experience of people who have been on these monitors, who have had a loved one on the monitor, who have tried to run some kind of community-based programs with people who are on the monitor. And the lived experience of people is very different than what the salespeople or the state put forward about this technology, let alone what the sort of gurus of technology or big tech, as some people refer to them, who present technology as the savior, that technology is going to save us. And that's technology being accepted uncritically, according to the mythology put forward by the companies that sell this. But I think it's really important to stress that And you, I think you've been bringing this out in the way a lot of you know, journalists and even some activists don't do, and that is, it's not the companies that drive this. The companies make profit out of it, but it takes state actors. It takes public elected officials and decision makers to take that decision to provide resources for the people that are using these technology to make these contracts. So BI, the largest electronic monitoring company in the U.S., has a monopoly on the technology that they put on electronic monitors that they put on immigrants. Well, they didn't get that by themselves. They had to get that by going through the Department of Homeland Security and through Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So people in decision-making positions are taking the decision, just like they did with building prisons and jails, that this is going to be helpful to somebody, and this is going to solve the problem. And we know it hasn't solved any of the problems it was supposed to solve.
Well, it's funny you say that, because we just had someone write in and send us a super chat on the YouTube chat. Left is Best writes, ankle monitors were key to sending migrants home with family and friends instead of having them crammed in cages. Think of the unintentional consequences. I don't know if that's is that them writing and saying it's positive. I mean, we're about to get to a story later in the program on how ICE sending them home with family and friends is not how I would describe their treatment necessarily. But I do want to expand a little bit on the immigration point that you could. Can you talk a little bit about, if you could talk a little bit more about the experiences of migrants with this kind of electronic surveillance, and how ICE has used this kind of technology to its benefit on the border?
Sure. Just to address a minute the idea that it's better. Because I mean, I've encountered this argument: it's better than jail, it's better than prison. And I think, I mean, what I always say is that I'm never going to say to someone who's sitting in a jail or prison, especially during COVID time, "Oh no, don't go on electronic monitor; it's really bad." Well, I know where you are is worse than that electronic monitor. But my point about that is that what we see as the best solution, or the optimal solution for an individual, isn't what we must look at when we look at the big picture. So yes, if someone wants to come out of a immigration prison and go and be with their family on electronic monitor, whatever the conditions are, maybe that's better for them as an individual. But is that what are we content with that? Are we going to say, this is good, this is the solution, let's move on to something else? And that's our point around electronic monitoring. We don't want electronic monitors. We want people to be given resources and access to opportunities, and not be tracked, not be confined to their house, but be given a chance to connect with their families in the same way that that's not happening under ICE and home and release and so forth. What are the conditions under which people are now subject to when they're put on these monitors or under the so-called alternatives to detention program of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement? So we're seeing right now that the Biden administration is cranking up the number of people that are going to be on surveillance. They're, in the past, most people who are under ICE on electronic monitors were not actually under house arrest. They could pretty much move around in most instances, but their data was being tracked and used in many ways against them. But now they're going to start to introduce at least 12 hours a day of house arrest as they expand the use of electronic monitors. So, I mean, I'm predicting that that's going to get tighter, number one. But number two, organizations like Just Futures Law, Mi Gente, have done incredible research looking at the ways in which companies like Palantir, LexisNexis, and so forth have been gathering the data on electronic monitoring. And this is one of the only instances where you can actually get national data, because it's under ICE, whereas with the other electronic monitors under county or state authority. So they're building all these networks of, you know, criminals and who's working and who's working without a permit, and also who's using state resources and not giving back.
Right. Right. And it's just expanding their cloud of knowledge. I want to now expand on what you talked about with Palestine, because that is just like, that is just such an important point. Because yes, it's a surveillance state, but it's not bound by state borders, by national borders. These are, the surveillance of Palestine makes total sense given the fact that Israel and the United States have a close relationship when it comes to sharing technology and the murderous technology that we use in the Middle East, we often share with them as well. And of course, that's being used in the oppression of the Palestinian people. They're already in an open air prison. Now, let's monitor them and imprison them even further.
Yes, I mean, well, I think it's interesting also that two of the biggest electronic monitoring companies in the U.S. are Israeli based. That's Atenti and Supercom. So they're, I mean, as you pointed out, they're really at the cutting edge of the development of a lot of this surveillance technology. And in fact, the Palestinians are, you know, really experimental subjects for a lot of this technology. And what I was really trying to point out in that chapter is the fact that people are beginning to talk about open air prisons in the United States, and the fact that a lot of, say, Black communities become like almost like an open air prison with the technologies that are used with stingrays and surveillance cameras and facial recognition, license plate readers, and extensive police occupation. And I mean, I wanted people to connect the dots between, you know, what happens in those communities and what's happening in a place like Palestine, but also to realize that in Palestine, there's a whole other dimension to this. And that is, A, that we have actual physical walls that keep them in there, physical barriers, and B, that the population is subject to military attack and bombing by the Israeli Defense Force, which isn't exactly what's happening in the U.S. But I think we just need to be aware that these things take different shape in different places, but there's still connections between the technology that's used and, most of all, the mentality of people that build systems, that build these punitive systems, which target certain populations.
Right. Yeah. We've talked about this a bit on the show before. There is a lot of shadiness and lack of clarity on the extent of the United States operations in Africa, where we have a larger presence than is widely publicized. And my guess is there is, I'm sure, a lot of testing being done there in terms of surveillance technology. But now I walk myself back a little bit there too, because a lot of it's just happening here in the United States on poorer populations as well.
But I think there's an important international connection there that the raw materials, the minerals that are used for a lot of this surveillance technology, are being mined in Africa by children in some cases, by super exploited labor. So, I mean, I think that's another way of connecting the dots of, you know, even in our cell phones, you know, we have various minerals and so forth that are coming from places like the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So we rely on exploiting that labor in order to be able to surveil, you know, countries and continents.
Yes. Well, I mean, your book is an incredible read. I would encourage everybody to check it out. James Kilgore, author of Understanding Ecarceration, Electronic Monitoring, The Surveillance State and the Future of Mass Incarceration. Thank you so much for being here with us and bearing with us on our first day with our new streaming situation. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Emma. It's been a great conversation. I appreciate your work.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you too as well. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, come back, wrap up the rest of the show. We are back. We are back. So yeah, we don't usually read super chats, but Matt, we're trying to incorporate that a little bit more. I think Matt was sending them to me, so I can't read that stuff.
Yeah, and I actually misread Left is Best as agreeing with the guest, but I will say it was
great
a good question to pose to that, because I think that is that's the pitch, right?
Right. I mean, alternatives are, it's just that. That's a more, he's coming from a more radical perspective than that.
Well, and a systemic one, right? Like, yes. At an individual level, like, I'm sure there are cases like that, but what does a technology like this do, allow, like, the security state to expand to, so all sorts of different things are monitored and that sort of stuff? Like,
right.
I think it is very worrisome. And I like his point about there's certain technologies we need to look at and be like, there's no point to this, other than points we don't agree with, and we should put a kibosh to this. That's not something people like to do in modern times, because you get accused of being a Luddite. But Luddism is good, actually.
But all right, let's before we head into the fun half, let's talk about this really disturbing story. So Sam Biddle of The Intercept wrote a story that I encourage everybody to check out. It's about Amazon, but it's not really about Amazon. It's really about our immigration privatization and what the United States actually does to human beings. So our generation does not fall for like the fanfic, oh, Alexander Hamilton or whatever. But there are a lot of still people who believe the U.S. is the greatest country on earth and is above these kinds of tactics.
That the Constitution is there to protect us and not to a conspiracy against people who have to work for a living or are owned by people,
right?
To keep them down. Yeah.
Yeah. That is the religion of the United States in many ways, but we've got multiple ones. Here, this kind of story should shake that belief at least a little bit. Amazon co-owns deportation airline implicated in alleged torture of immigrants. So this piece that Bradley's putting up here, it's disturbing, just a bit of a warning in terms of what's described by what is done by Omni Air International, which is responsible for a lot of the deportation efforts by the United States government. Amazon quietly became a partial owner of Air Transport Services Group Incorporated, a power player in the air cargo industry that has helped the United States forcibly deport thousands of migrants and, its passengers allege, at times subjected them to horrific abuse en route. On March 9th, 2021, Amazon purchased 19.5% of ATSG for $131 million and currently reserves options that would let it expand that stake to 40%. Among ATSG's various aviation subsidiaries is Omni Air International, a passenger charter firm that moves humans on behalf of the federal government. Its two most prominent federal customers are the DOD, which uses the firm for troop transports, and the Department of Homeland Security, which has paid the company reportedly exorbitant fees over the years in order to execute so-called special high-risk charter flights for its ICE Air deportation machine. Immigration and Customs Enforcement deals with Omni through an intermediary, Classic Air Charter Incorporated, a flight logistics firm whose parent company previously helped transport CIA prisoners to black sites to be tortured. Just a sense of what we're dealing with here. And so again, this is less about Amazon, and like honestly, I would imagine that Biddle and The Intercept wanted to put Amazon in the headline because one, yes, they are culpable, but two, it's a little bit more clicky. But really, this is a systemic conversation about the privatization of the worst parts of our government because it creates less oversight and it gets people rich in the process. The deportation flight abuse crisis is attributed directly to the opacity of firms like Omni. And this is a quote from a 2019 U of Washington human rights study. Over the past decades, the institutional infrastructure behind these flights has shifted from a government operation run by the U.S. Marshals Service on government planes to a sprawling semi-secret network of flights on privately owned aircraft. One of the more infamous examples is a notoriously botched 2017 removal flight to Somalia, which the center believes was operated by Omni, on which deportees alleged physical beatings, the use of straitjackets, verbal abuse and threats, and the denial of access to restrooms, which forced passengers to soil themselves in their seats. Even without specific allegations of abuse, the flights come with inherent brutality for deportees. So outside of these reported, I mean, making them soil their pants on an international flight, which is many, many hours to Africa, that constitutes abuse. But even the baseline usage of these flights is abusive. The flights come with an inherent brutality for deportees who remain bound and shackled for the entirety of an international flight, at times upward of 30 hours or more with stopovers. Nearly 100 formal allegations of abuse and mistreatment aboard ICE Air flights were filed to the Department of Homeland Security's Office for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties between 2007 and 2018, including a 2012 incident in which an ICE detainee miscarried her triplets aboard a removal flight to El Salvador. They place them in what is called a wrap, which is essentially a straitjacket, but worse. The wrap incapacitates individuals by binding their legs together and their arms behind their back in a semi-seated position using a mummy-like set of harnesses, locks, and chains. This is one of the complaints filed to the Department of Homeland Security's Office for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties by a coalition of immigrant advocacy groups and the Texas A&M University School of Law. It details the harrowing experience of three migrants deported by Omni Air, alleging that ICE is using the wrap in a manner that constitutes torture or cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment in violation of the Convention Against Torture. And this is a quote from one of the men. One man recounted that after he was being thrown to the ground and shot with rubber bullets, he was placed in the wrap and loaded onto an Omni flight where his body remained locked in at a 40-degree angle for about 9 hours. It was so painful, he said. The position was very stressful on my body. My muscles were shot with pain the entire bus ride and flight back to Cameroon. And a lot of this is taken from a report by Sarah Towley, who put a lot of this together and interviewed these people.
Jesus.
So I wanted to talk about that, one, because it was germane to the interview that we just did. But two, because this is how our government gets away with and, in fact, executes with in a cloak and dagger way the worst of U.S. empire. They privatize it. Companies like Amazon make money off of it. And then shadier companies that are more behind the scenes that do deals with companies like Amazon make money off of it. Everybody gets rich off human suffering. And the United States, what they get out of it, yeah, there's a bit of plausible deniability, even though they know exactly what they're doing when they outsource this to companies like this.
Yeah, and then let's return to lecturing other countries about human rights.
Yeah. Right. We're that boycott of the Olympics. Someone ask Joe Biden about this story and then talk about the, I mean, again, not an excuse about cultural genocide of the Uyghurs, but the hypocrisy in the United States and the idea that we use our platform to wag our fingers as we do things like this. Give me a break.
Yeah, exactly. I think like the idea that I think it's very, it should be, it shouldn't be, you know, that controversial that you keep an eye on the body politic you're a member of most. And I'm sorry, like the way that it acts in these sorts of ways, and like also in Afghanistan, like just killing hundreds of thousands of people. I'm not like going to give it my warrant in, you know, being a defender of human rights, because I think it's appalling what it's actively doing, and it has been doing my entire lifetime. All of our entire lifetimes, our parents' entire lifetimes before that.
Well, that is that. That is the first hour of our program. Thank you all so much for tuning in. We are going to head into the fun half shortly, but first, Left Reckoning was last night.
Oh, yeah, it was. We had a very fun show with Pascal and Jason from This Is Revolution. We talked about a whole lot. Man, where to start? Jason has a big thing on Bill Cosby, so we talked a little bit about that in media and the types of message that different sorts of audiences would take from the Cosby Show growing up in Hubble. They're all pretty much bad.
Did you like the Cosby Show? Because I did.
So I sort of watched it, but I'll be honest, like, I never really, I got into more like Jamie Foxx and Martin.
Yeah.
Like Cosby Show was like in reruns by the time I was sort of old enough to like watch TV and
Nick at Night. That was like where I got.
Right. Yeah. And, like but like I didn't watch it enough to like know the characters' names and stuff like that. Yeah, we talked a little bit about that and how, you know, comparatively young me and David are. And then we had a fun post game where we talk about privatizing the moon to save poverty and how a neoliberal think tank has had that bright idea. I don't know why. It's just a little media lesson. Like, if a neoliberal think tank says we should privatize the moon, that's not a news story. But if they say we should privatize the moon to save poverty, the Independent has to write it up and be like, oh, this think tank thinks you have to do it. Like,
right, right.
Anyways, so check that out, patreon.com/leftwrecking. We had a really fun show last night. And,
we have them there?
So, yeah. So I am, yeah, we'll...
Wait.
Letting them into the show on the fly. We're gonna have to take a break and then we'll get right to their plugs. I apologize. I'll include them in the show, but getting them into OBS might take a little bit. So we're gonna take a little break.
Okay.
And then we'll
figuring it out.
Yeah.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh no! Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back.
Snowflakes has what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bank, okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.